originally estimated by the department, and so we're kind of juggling things around to accommodate people's schedules. And so today we will be taking up the health care recommendations, and Assistant Commissioner Brian Osberg will join us at the table for that. I just have a couple of comments before you begin, Assistant Commissioner. I think it would be fair to say that since quite a few of the members of this division worked on health care reform very hard last year and for the year prior to that, that it would be sort of an understatement to say that we are disappointed at the retreat from health care reform that we see in this proposal. And so we would invite you going forward to reconsider some of these ideas and to be trying to think more in a reform mode in regard to value-based purchasing. I would say most of this is going backward from that concept.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Brian Osberg, Assistant Commissioner of Healthcare, Department of Human Services, and we'd be glad to talk more about that very thing. We certainly are interested in pursuing healthcare reform. You're right, some of these proposals set back in terms of access for individuals in this state, because access and affordability is what the healthcare reform legislation tries to address and to advance. And so we'd be glad to talk to you during the course of the session as to how we continue to reform the healthcare system in the context of these proposals or of our programs.
Well, I think we need to do more than talk about it. I think we need to do more of it and less of this. Shall we begin?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is Brian Osberg, Assistant Commissioner of Healthcare, Department of Human Services. The pages that we're going to present represent the proposal cover Minnesota healthcare programs, medical assistance, Minnesota care, and general assistance medical care, the three Minnesota healthcare programs. The programs cover more than 670,000 people today, with that number expected to grow to approximately 709,000 by July 1st. This includes low-income families with children, adults without children, pregnant women, elderly, and people with disabilities, including those in nursing facilities. Approximately half of our clients are children. The governor's proposed budget results in the disenrollment of approximately 84,000 low-income adults who are currently enrolled in Minnesota care. This includes 55,000 adults without children who lose Minnesota care coverage effective January 2010, and 29,000 parents who lose Minnesota care coverage effective July 2010. Under current law, enrollment in the Minnesota healthcare programs is expected to increase by approximately 100,000 people in the next 2 years. With these proposed budget changes, enrollment will drop by 12,000 to just under 700,000 people by the end of the biennium.
Assistant Commissioner Osberg, would you say that the reason for the growth in enrollment during this period of time is because the traditional system for most people to receive their health care is really failing us?
Madam Chair, the primary factor, of course, in terms of the growth in this program is the economy and the downturn of the economy, which impacts, of course, employers' ability to provide coverage. And, of course, impacts, given that we have an employer-based insurance system, that is clearly a major factor. But the economy, obviously, is what causes this growth in the next 2 years. Children enrolled in Minnesota healthcare programs will also be affected by these proposals, not because of eligibility changes for children, but due to other factors, including the elimination of outreach efforts, the elimination of premium reductions, and most significantly, the elimination of the proposed medical assistance transitional care program for kids coming off of MA eligibility. In total, there will be approximately 28,000 more children enrolled in our programs under these proposals by the end of the biennium, about 26,000 fewer than projected under current law. And we'll go through more detail the enrollment effect later on. State spending for the current biennium for these programs is projected to be $4.7 billion. It is projected to be $6.27 billion for the next biennium under current law, a 33% increase. This is due primarily to the growth in enrollment. Under the governor's proposal, it is projected to be $5.23 billion, 11% increase. Developments at the federal level, reauthorization of SCHIP, the State Children's Health Insurance Program, and the stimulus package could have a major impact on financing our healthcare programs in the near term. And we'd be glad to talk about that, if you wish. While it is too soon to speculate on how the stimulus package will affect the governor's proposals, we hope that it will be known before the production of the next budget forecast. And I'll address this further in my presentation. Meanwhile, we are tracking the federal activity closely and can provide analysis to the committee, if you wish. To better follow our change pages, they are broken into six categories, and you have a sheet that does that.
Kind of a table of contents.
It's kind of exactly right. I think this is a better flow in terms of presenting these change pages instead of going through the order in the book, and unfortunately, we didn't have a chance to reorder the pages. So I'll take you through, obviously, page by page. And the five categories are federal compliance, reform and simplification, payment delays, reimbursement changes, benefit changes, and eligibility changes. Those are the five categories of change pages that we'll take you through. First, starting on page 92, this proposal would fund the implementation of the federally mandated public assistance reporting information system called PARIS for Minnesota state health care programs. It's a computer data matching system and information exchange system administered by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, a tool to improve program integrity. It matches state enrollment data with other states and selected federal databases in order to identify if individuals are enrolled in public programs in other states. This provides funding for the necessary system changes in one FTE. Initial implementation cost is $113,000, projected savings of $55,000 per year after that. Again, it's a federal requirement that we adopt this. And over time, as I just indicated, it would certainly be in our
interest. Assistant Commissioner, so we've been hearing a lot, especially from the minority on the other side of the building, about program integrity in regard to enrollment in our public programs. Is this going to be provide greater integrity in that regard?
Madam Chair, yes, it will.
And is it something that you can compare across state lines to see if people are enrolled in more than one program in more than one state, or?
Madam Chair, yes, exactly right.
Can you determine actual legal address through this mechanism?
Madam Chair, I don't know how specific the data is, but we certainly are able to identify individuals. I don't have any details since it's not yet in place.
Well, I just thought you might have looked into it a little bit since you're required to do it, and it's on budget page here.
I'm sure our staff has done that. We'll get back to you with more specifics if you wish.
All right. Any other questions about this page? Go on then.
Page 93, this proposal is for budget and statutory changes needed to implement new federal requirements mandated in the 2008 Medicare legislation. This law makes several changes to the administration of Medicare Part D low-income subsidy, which is the drug coverage for Medicare, and Medicare savings programs, which we administer, which provides cost sharing and premium coverage for people or low-income Medicare. So this is a placeholder. We're still waiting for direction from DHS as to how this would be done. However, we anticipate that we'll need $67,000 in fiscal year 2010 to develop the system changes necessary, because what will happen is that we will get applications from SSA, the Medicare Social Security Administration. They'll identify us in terms of people who may be eligible for our Medicare savings programs because they're applying for low-income subsidy on Medicare Part D. This is an effort to allow more individuals who may be eligible for Medicare savings programs to be connected back to our process. Otherwise, they're administered in terms of eligibility. They're administered separately, as you probably know. Medicare Part D is a federal.
Yes, we've noticed the mess they've made of it.
It is a problem that we've been trying to help over the years. Correct, yes.
But we also, I have at least, tended to have the feeling that Medicare Part D is their program, and if they want us to help people with it, they should pay for it. We shouldn't have to be paying for their program, including
Chair,
the administration of their program.
I would agree, Madam Chair. That's not been offered at this point.
Well, I think we need to keep making that point over and over again rather than just saying, oh, well, that's the way it is.
Page 94, this proposal would establish what's called a reasonable limits policy that allows unpaid medical expenses incurred up to 3 months before the effective date of eligibility for MA long-term care to be deducted when calculating the client's current income that must be contributed to their cost of care. This reduces the client's contribution to the cost of care, resulting in an increase in MA expenditures of $500,000 a year. Minnesota's current policy on unreasonable limits permits a client to deduct unpaid bills incurred during the time they're eligible, not prior to their eligibility. CMS did not approve this policy when it was submitted as a state plan amendment, to our disappointment. CMS determined it should be consistent with rules for establishing MA eligibility under an income spend down. People are allowed to spend down below the income standard and be covered through medical assistance, as you know, which allows a deduction from income for expenses incurred prior to the eligibility period. So they're asking us to apply the same method. The proposal would prohibit income deductions for the cost of services or equipment that are covered under the state plan. As you see, as I indicated, there's a cost of $500,000 associated with this change.
Are there questions about this page? Okay, let's keep going then.
The next category of pages around reform simplification, at times I'm going to reference the asset guidelines and pages 15 and 16 in the green pages in your book, but we'll, as we get to those items, we can discuss what asset and income standards we have currently. Page 95 is the IEP funding cap. This proposal would eliminate the dollar limit, $350,000 per fiscal year, on administrative costs retained by DHS from payments to school districts for covered individualized education program services, special education services. School districts get reimbursed. They provide the match, the non-federal match, and get reimbursed for healthcare services to people who are on IEP programs. This proposal has passed the committee before and has also been endorsed by the Department of Education. Currently, administrative costs are retained to pay for administering the program at DHS, including the cost of training and technical assistance, staff salaries and benefits for IEP policy coordinator, a fraud and abuse investigator, and other staff. Travel and equipment. We expect to exceed $350,000 this next year, fiscal year, so we need to lift this limit. DHS would still be limited to retaining 5%, no more than 5% of the federal share for IEP services, and would still be required to rebate any difference to the school districts. So we would continue to do that. We've rebated like $480,000 this past year to the school districts. So it's not as though we're going to all of a sudden spend all the way up to the 5%. In fact, we intend to keep it around 2% the best we can. That's my objective. But this was enacted before, and it was caught up in some other legislation last year.
Any questions about this page?
I'd like to now jump to page 130. Page 130, this aligns medical assistance asset limits. This proposal would realign the asset limit for parents in medical assistance and Minnesota care with the MA asset limit for the elderly, blind, and disabled. Under current law, parents in MA and Minnesota care have an asset limit of $10,000 for a household of one and $20,000 for a household of two or more. The assets the asset limits would be $3,000 for a household of one, $6,000 for a household of two, and $200 for each additional dependent. The MA asset limit for parents would be reduced effective January 1st, 2010. The Minnesota Care asset limit would be reduced effective July 2010, or upon federal approval, whichever is later. This proposal makes no changes to the methodology for counting assets for MA or Minnesota Care parents. This proposal represents both a reduction in the asset limits, but also provides for program simplification for purposes of processing Minnesota Healthcare Program applications so that we have the same standard. So it does result in savings, as you see on this page, because the MA asset standard would be less than it is today for Minnesota parents and for Minnesota Care.
And I'm assuming that part of this proposal in reducing assets would be to use the savings from the Minnesota Care portion of the proposal to balance the general fund.
Madam Chair, this does not interact directly with, of course, the page that provides for the healthcare access fund being brought into the general fund. As you know, later on, the proposal provides for the elimination of Minnesota Care parents and Minnesota Care adults without kids. So it doesn't interact with that page either, I believe.
Well, where would the breakout of the savings for the various programs be found then?
It would be found under current funding, the Healthcare Access Fund as well as General Fund, both. I believe, certainly. Madam Chair, I've been corrected. It's all in the general fund. I have to get that information to you as to how this interacts with the healthcare access fund. Please, it does not. Apparently, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I was informed that because of the repeal of the parents, Minnesota Care, this is all a general fund effect. So in other words, just Minnesota Care, maybe MA parents effect only. So the Minnesota Care side would not have an
effect. Nobody left to be affected.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Okay, any more questions on this page? Let's move on then.
Page 131, this aligns the Medicare Savings Program. This proposal aligns the asset limit for individuals enrolled in Medicare savings programs, what we call MSP. Again, we provide premium and cost-sharing assistance to low-income Medicare beneficiaries. With the asset limits for individuals who apply for the Medicare Part D low-income subsidy, effective January 1st, 2010, the low-income subsidy provides assistance with premiums and cost-sharing for certain individuals enrolled in Medicare Part D. Medicare savings programs provides assistance to low-income Medicare beneficiaries to pay for their premiums and cost sharing. This proposal aligns the MSP asset limit with the LIS, the Medicare Part D low income subsidy asset limit, to $6,600 for a single person and $9,910. Today, under MSP, they're $10,000 for a single person and $18,000 for a married couple. Federal law requires states to maintain the current asset limit for what's called QWD. It's for 200% people in Medicare, is 200% standard. So that doesn't change.
So it's not really clear to me why we get savings off of this, if this is all about Medicare.
No, Madam Chair, we get savings on the Medicare savings program because we contribute in part. If you look back to page 17 in your green section of your book, you will see that we do contribute in part to the Medicare savings programs. It's not just pro dollars. So by reducing the asset limit for Medicare savings programs, we do accrue savings. If you look at that chart, the graph that lays out the various programs and the standards, income and asset standards, you'll see that.
Right, but I don't see Medicare on here. It's, Medical Assistance, Minnesota Care, GAMC.
No, Medicare, if you look under to the right, it's QMB, SLMB, Q1, QI1, and QWD. These are all the Medicare savings programs that we're talking about.
Quimby and Slimby, yeah.
Quimby and Slimby, right.
Okay.
And
So we're going to make it harder for people to be in those programs.
Madam Chair, that's what this. The fact is that the asset limit goes down from 10 and 18 down to 6,600 and 9,910. Again, in part to align with Medicare Part D, but also there's to achieve some savings.
Any other questions on this page?
Okay. Page 132, this proposal would amend medical assistance estate recovery statutes to create the authority for counties and the state to collect from the estate of the recipient's surviving spouse for MA benefits received. Under Minnesota and federal law, a recovery from a claim may not be made until after the death of a surviving spouse. Minnesota law limits a claim against a non-recipient spouse's estate for benefits received by the recipient spouse to the value of property in the estate that was marital property or jointly owned property at any time during the marriage. However, a recent Minnesota Supreme Court decision held that MA recoveries from spousal estates are limited to the recipient's legal interest at the time of death. The decision disallows MA recoveries in situations where recipients transfer property to their community spouse prior to death. And we certainly didn't anticipate this ruling. In fact, we're petitioning this decision to the U.S. Supreme Court. This proposal would amend state law to create marital interest as legal title interest for MA estate recovery, allowing counties and the state to collect from the estate of the recipient's surviving spouse for MA benefits received by the recipient spouse.
So is this more or less a proposal that keeps things the way it was before this court ruling?
Madam Chair, exactly.
Okay. Any other questions on this page?
Madam Chair, page 133, this proposal would modify medical assistance policy that allows a person to become eligible for reducing certain assets, be they health-related or not. The proposal will allow a person to become eligible by paying bills for healthcare services incurred during the period for which eligibility is sought. Expenditures that are not for health services incurred during the period for which eligibility is sought will no longer count towards reducing assets to the MA limit. We think that this is just appropriate, that only those health care expenses should be the ones to count towards the spend down towards the MA asset limit and not other expenses. So this clarifies that and makes that clear that only health expenses will be recognized in terms of the reduction of assets.
Well, you know, Assistant Commissioner, we're talking about oftentimes a group of very low-income people here, elderly and disabled people on the Medicaid program are very low-income, and sometimes if a person inherits a little bit of money because someone in their family dies, there are other things that they need to purchase besides health care. And, traditionally we have allowed them, you know, to pay off other bills they might have or to purchase things that they need for activities of daily living.
Madam Chair, that may be, certainly by definition, our clients are low income. However, in terms of trying to determine we have an asset limit, as you know, $3,000 for individual and $6,000 for a couple. And we do allow, and rightly so, for some spend down in order to meet that asset limit. But we think that it should not be spend down should be healthcare related, medically related, and not other expenses. We just think
Is this page talking about things that would happen on a month-to-month basis where somebody's $25 over the income limit and They have to spend down $25 a month before they get any assistance from Medicaid.
Madam Chair, I'm going to seek some guidance on that. Is that just for the initial eligibility or for ongoing?
Madam Chair, Senators, this would just, I'm Kim Carlin from Department of Human Services. This proposal just is for a policy when a person comes to the door and applies for medical assistance, if their assets are over the limit at that time, then they would have to reduce their assets by paying medical bills or unpaid medical bills that they have. So it's just at that point in time when they come seeking assistance from medical assistance, because we are the payer of last resort. So if they have resources that they can provide, we would ask them to use those resources first, and then we would cover at that point.
Okay.
So we would start paying with the first dollar of their services after they had met that reduction.
Right. So I understand this better now.
Okay.
Thank you. Are there other questions? While you're getting to the next page, Assistant Commissioner, we have this quite lengthy and detailed chart about the enrollment effect of each proposal, but none of these asset reduction recommendations are included on the chart, and we're sure they would have some enrollment effect.
Madam Chair, I was informed that the two pages, this one and the prior one, is 2,800 effect, 2,800 enrollment effect.
Well, what we'd like you to do is provide for us in writing for each page so that we can decide when we decide whether we're accepting a page or not, you know, what
Madam, Madam Chair, we've done that for everything else. I apologize. We will do that for these two pages as well, but every other page does have a specific effect, and it's on that chart.
Let's move on then.
Page 135, this proposal makes a number of changes related to the MA treatment of pool trusts and special needs trusts and limits the conditions under which a period of ineligibility for non-compensated transfer can be adjusted. It would clarify that a transfer of assets into a pooled trust for a person 65 or older must be evaluated as a transfer for less than fair market value. This policy is consistent with guidance DHS has received from CMS. Pooled trusts and special needs trusts are two types of trusts for disabled individuals recognized under state and federal law. Specific rules apply regarding who may establish, fund, and administer the trust and the purpose of the trust. This proposal will do the following. One is require trustees to submit an annual financial report to DHS for a pool trust or a special needs trust when the beneficiary of the trust is a Minnesota healthcare program enrollee. Number two is clarify that a transfer of assets into a pool trust for a person 65 or older must be evaluated as a possible transfer for less than fair market value. Number three, require that on the death of a pool trust beneficiary, any funds remaining in the MA recipient's subaccount be used to fully reimburse the state for the cost of providing MA before any subaccount funds can be retained by the trust. Uncompensated transfer proposal would require the full amount of transferred assets to be returned to a person who's applying within 12 months of the start date of a penalty period to eliminate the penalty period. It would no longer allow the recalculation of a penalty period based on a partial return of transferred assets. A hardship waiver of the penalty period may be granted in some situations when a person is unable to recover the full value of transferred assets. This results in general fund savings that increases over time, as you see on the page.
Are there any questions about this page? Assistant Commissioner, I probably distracted you a little bit about the chart, and so we've skipped page 134 if you want to go back to it.
Madam Chair, I'll come back to page 134 later in the presentation.
Oh, well. Whatever you
based
wish.
Based on my table of contents that I provided.
Well, it's on your table of contents.
I apologize. I'm gonna address it later on under the eligibility
piece. I guess you've got it here in two places.
I do. I apologize. Madam Chair, page 137, this proposal would allow contracting for special transportation services in the 11-county metro area for fee-for-service clients. As you know, we had this in place at one point, and we believe we should go back to this policy. Currently, a vendor contracted by DHS coordinates access transportation, which is the lower level of transportation, in the 11-county metro area. They also certify clients for the STS, the Special Transportation Services, level of service statewide by providing a level of need assessment. DHS would be authorized to contract with a vendor for the management of STS services in the 11-county metro area for our fee-for-service clients. This would not affect our managed care clients. The managed care organizations continue to manage transportation services in the way they best deem possible. Management of the cost of these services, particularly STS for wheelchair and ambulatory clients, have been an ongoing issue. STS is the highest cost level of transportation. And we believe, again, that we should go back, for purposes of achieving savings, but also to better coordinate transportation for our clients. And you will certainly hear a lot about this, but there's a number of STS providers who believe we should go back to this arrangement. And the STS providers obviously feel strongly that we should not go back to this arrangement. And as I'm sure you're going to hear a lot about this proposal.
Any questions about this page?
Savings is about $1 million in the biennium. Page 138.
Senator Lynch.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. I do have a couple of questions in this area. And, Commissioner, I know that you are aware of the fact that Senator Sharon has been leading a work group on this issue for a number of months now, and that work is not yet completed. But specifically with regard to this budget page, I wondered if you could – you talk about increasing the – vendor, increasing the broker in this case, and what is being spent on that total contract to reestablish the broker. And I'm wondering if you can further delineate the savings that you show here, if you could provide some further detail of where that savings transpires and where it's coming from.
Right, this budget page shows no expenditures, and there obviously would be some.
Madam Chair, I assume that the offset, the administrative offset, is part of this calculation.
Right, but we like to have it broken down.
It's very, Madam Chair, that's a very appropriate request. We will do that. We'll break that down as to exactly what the savings, how we calculate the savings, as well as what the administrative costs associated with contracting with a broker would be.
And Madam Chair.
The other issue you've created with this page is that if there are additional administrative costs, you have to have them appropriated to you. Unless you're planning to take it out of some slush fund you've got in the department that I don't know about yet.
Madam Chair, I assume that's correct. I will ask our finance people to...
The former is correct or the latter is correct?
Well, I assume what you said is correct, that we would need administrative appropriation for us to do this. That's what is implicit in this proposal, but we will break that down in terms of that administrative request.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, I think this has really been a healthy discussion to have because we have been asking for that level of detail for quite some time, and it's my opinion that the work group on this issue, it has become increasingly clear that in this particular area, the system is not working for our patients, for our clients that it's designed to serve. It's not working operationally, and I would argue that not working financially. So it is imperative that this committee get that level of detail and get it sooner rather than later.
Madam Chair, we are participating. We want to continue to work with Senator Sharon's work group and to help sort this out. So we'd be glad to provide information to that work group as well. But we'll bring that information back to the committee exactly how this is going to be broken down in terms of savings and administrative costs.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much. I would also, in terms of discussing any kind of changes in the system, need the number that we need to also be looking at is how much it costs to go through the appeal process once a decision is made by a centralized system for special transportation services located outside of the state of Minnesota that does not have direct access to the patient. Has created a number of appeals that and we should take a look at how many of those appeals have been heard, and so the decisions of the original organization have been turned over. It creates that cost as well, not only in the lives of the state of Minnesota, but the lives of the clients. So I will agree with you. There'll be significant discussion not only about the expansion of STS services provided by MNET, but the reduction of those services because of the problems that the clients are having in having their needs met. So this will be one that we will be looking very closely at. And I also would like to say, Chair Berglund, that that I agree that many of the STS providers will have difficulty with this, but it isn't just the STS providers. It's the clients and many of the senators and legislators representing especially the rural part of the state have a great deal of difficulty with what's been happening with special transportation services.
In fact, Madam Chair, the next page addresses that in part.
Assistant Commissioner, I just have one more comment to make about this page, and that is it's a comment I made earlier to the Department of Health as well. When we don't have all the information on a page, it is very difficult to ask the questions that we might have about it. And as you know, when we get the information later, you all are not here if we have questions about it. And so it makes the discussion of the division, it hampers it somewhat. Any page. Other questions about this page? If not, then let's go on to the next page.
Page 138. This proposal would increase the mileage rate for special transportation services for people who require a wheelchair-accessible van and decrease the mileage rate for STS services for people who do not require a wheelchair-accessible van to ensure continued access, especially in rural areas. Not all people who have met the level of need for STS are in wheelchairs. Ambulatory people who have cognitive or physical disabilities may qualify for ambulatory STS if they need such assistance, but do not need to be transported in a wheelchair-accessible van. STS providers in rural areas have been experiencing financial hardships, as has been talked about, because of miles traveled and fewer trips affecting access for our clients. This proposal, effective July 1st, 2009, increases per mile rates for STS services for people who require a wheelchair-accessible van from $1.35 to $1.80, and decreases the per mile rate for STS services for people who do not require a wheelchair accessible van from $1.30 to $1. And there's a net savings $211,000 in the 10-11 biennium.
Are there questions about this page? Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, I would just comment that while at first blush and on this single piece of paper as a standalone, this may look attractive to some parts of the state and to some, frankly, to some members. But I would just encourage us, as I know we will, look at special transportation as the whole in the package and the service that we are charged with providing as a complete package.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair, I'm now going to go back to page 117.
Assistant Commissioner, let's go on to the next page then.
Madam Chair, page 117, we'll go back to that in terms of talk about payment delays. The next four pages relate to provider payment delays. Again, I'm trying to categorize these pages in various topics. Page 117, this proposal increases the financial withhold amount for Minnesota Care Managed Care contracts to align with MA and GAMC. It also eliminates the withhold exemption for the Minnesota Disability Health Options Program. Minnesota Care withhold would increase from 5% to 8% to align with the amount withheld under MA and GAMC the last year or the year before. The additional 3% would be automatically returned to the managed care organizations in July of the following fiscal year. The return of these funds is not contingent on plan performance. This first 5% is contingent on plan performance, but the next 3 is not. The language excluding special demonstration projects such as MINDO from the withhold would be repealed. The first 5% would be subject, again, to performance targets. The additional 3% would not. $7.8 million savings in the 10 of 11 biennium.
And I think when we created the withhold, we intentionally had the Minnesota Care portion be less as a way of creating less hardship on the managed care plans. Some of the managed care plans, you know, are small. So the reason for this savings would be to use Minnesota Care to balance the general fund?
Madam Chair, that would have, given these proposals in the whole, that would have that effect.
Assistant Commissioner, I want to be very clear. I think I've been very clear in the past that we're not going to use Minnesota Care as a slush fund for the general fund. We're not going to transfer Minnesota Care into the general fund. We're not going to do it now. We're not going to do it next year. We're not going to do it the year after, just like we didn't do it last year or the year before or the year before when the administration has made these proposals. I don't know how much clearer I can be about that.
Madam Chair, you have been clear about that.
Well, I'm certainly glad at least I've been clear to you. Are there any other questions about this page? Let's go on then.
Page 118, this proposal would eliminate the first 3 months of the calendar year 2011 rebasing of hospital rates under medical assistance and GAMC programs. Current law requires the department to rebase each hospital's MA and GAMC inpatient fee-for-service rates forward every 2 years based on costs of each hospital. The next rebasing will take place in 2011. This proposal would not result in a rate decrease. But there's a $21.4 million savings in the fiscal year 10 and 11 biennium. For the committee's information, at this point, in the forecast, in the current forecast, in terms of rebasing hospital rates, and as I said, we rebase hospital rates every 2 years, there's about $370 million in terms of increases to hospitals projected in the next 4 years. That's in the forecast today, based on what we think the rebasing will be for 2011 and 2013 for hospitals. Now, we're taking 3 months of the 2011 effect in this page, the $21 million. Rebasing is done for each hospital specific. It's hospital-specific costs are rebased. And the reason there's so much rebasing effect in 2011 is because it'll be a four-year catch-up because 2009 rebasing did not take place. We can talk more about the overall effect of this, but I just want to let you know that in the forecast, there's an increase. Now, we also, as you'll see in a second, we reduce payments to hospitals in a major way in this proposal, but you have to put that in the context. Hospitals are the only provider group that have a automatic adjustment increase. No other provider group has that, but it's not to say that there's not a major impact on hospitals near term. That we can go over that overall impact in some detail if you wish. But on this page, we're saying that the 2011 rebasing that's going to take place under current law, we're going to capture 3 months of that.
And that's equates to 21.5 million dollars, as you see on this page.
Assistant Commissioner, isn't it correct to say that we've gone through two rebasing cycles where we've delayed rebasing?
Madam Chair, I know the 2009. I don't know if it's two. I mean, Madam Chair, it's 2005 and 2009. There's two rebasing periods that we have. No, when you skip, it means another 2 years is added to the next one. It just accumulates because you go back before, instead of going back 2 year period of time to update their costs, you go back 4 year period of time. And that's what's going to happen in 2011. So we'll go back a 4 year period of time for each hospital and update their costs. That's why there's roughly a 30 some percent increase expected in the 2011 rebasing in a vary by hospital because the hospital's costs vary, of course. But on the aggregate, we're we're forecasting a increase around 30 some percent, 31, I believe.
Are there any other questions about this page? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to be meeting with our hospital administration and medical professionals in our community actually tomorrow in Bemidji. And I know following the governor's unallotment and the way that it affected hospitals, the hospital administrator at for North Country Regional Hospital gave a long summary of the impact just of that unallotment and the cuts we've already made to hospitals in recent years. In a community like Bemidji, he said the level we're paying for patients right now for all government-paid health care is about 85% of the cost of providing the service. And there's a good article, and I think it's the December 31st Bemidji Pioneer that lays this all out. But essentially what we're doing, as he explained, is shifting the cost to people who are trying to pay for health care themselves because they have to make up the difference in order to keep their doors open, as, you know, I think we all understand. We're going to be increasing the number of, and then as a consequence, we just push people off of insurance because it becomes less affordable. So we're going to be, not only are we going to be making it more difficult for hospitals to keep their doors open, but we're going to be making it much more difficult and expensive for individuals to pay for their own health care when they're not on one of these government-paid types of programs. And I'm afraid what I'm going to hear tomorrow is, you know, we're maybe going to be even threatening the viability of a lot of hospitals and health care services in rural Minnesota. So, I mean, these are people who work in the field. It's not a political statement, or it's just a statement of fact from people who are working in the healthcare community that we're threatening their existence, particularly in rural Minnesota. And
so, Senator Olson, when you meet with your hospital administrator to discuss these things, I hope that you'll ask them what they suggest we do instead, because it's unfortunately one of about the only places where you can actually get money out of the budget that is allowed under federal law for us to make reductions. And that's why, unfortunately, last session there were cuts that I didn't especially want to make in the budget. But every year we seem to keep going back there. But, you know, we really need some alternative ideas here.
Madam Chair, they actually did have very significant ideas, and they basically were along the lines of the waste that they see in the system. We've had a lot of different discussions about this over the last 2 years, but they were very much encouraging us to move toward a single-payer direction. And they see a lot of significant savings within the system if we move in that direction. That's been their feedback to me.
Well, I'd like to hear what their suggestions would be for eliminating waste short of doing that, since I doubt very much that's going to happen this year. And I need to have things that we can do this year. Mm-hmm. So if they'd like to give them to you in writing so that you can pass them on to me, I'd appreciate it. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate both the Chair's comments and Senator Olson's comments on this issue. And I would just ask that as a division, I think that it is irresponsible, and I think that it is we can't make a decision on this particular budget page in and of itself. Rather, I believe as a division that we need to look at all of the budget pages that impact hospitals and the cumulative effect, the history behind it, so that we are at least well versed on the decisions that are being made. And I would suggest that there are the hospitals are a great example when we talk about the need to understand that all of the tools that need to be put on the table and everything needs to be fully vetted and discussed. This is a great example because, as the Chair has pointed out, for whatever reason, the hospitals have been viewed as an auxiliary checkbook. And I just think that we need to take a cumulative look at where we've been and where we're going so that we have our eyes open.
And I agree with you, Senator Lynch, that we need to take and look at the proposals in total because obviously it doesn't do very much good if you're waiting to get rebased till sometime in 2011 in regard to your general assistance medical care population if by 2011 there is none.
Madam Chair, it may be useful for us to come in and explain all the methods by which we pay hospitals. I mean, it is a series of complex arrangements. We'd be glad to come in and give you a primer about how hospitals are paid through medical assistance. It's quite complicated, and I think it might be useful for you to understand every aspect of that. We address some of those aspects, but not all of them here in our budget pages.
Any more questions on this page? Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, a couple days ago I passed out a sheet that showed, and I don't know how many of you still have that, I'd be willing to pass it out again, that this would be a representative example of how the various cuts affect at least my city. And I'm sure that we could do the same for each one of the hospitals in your community. And, in fact, this also has the hospitals and their percent of public payments on it. But it is broken down by each one of the cuts, eliminating the GAMC, eliminating Minnesota Care, the 3% basic care cuts, the rebasing cuts, the ratable reductions, and the 16 DRGs that we fought so hard to equalize Greater Minnesota by obtaining a few years ago, and what those cuts mean to our areas. And I would recommend that you kind of use this as an example as we talk about these cuts that are occurring to hospitals, because taken together, they're significant. And as I mentioned before, just for the city of Duluth and the three hospitals there, this represents a $36 million cut in one biennium for our hospitals. That's enormous.
Madam Chair?
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Solon, do you know what percentage cut that would reflect in terms of the cut?
I don't, but when you consider that our hospitals, we could work it out, our public payments in the city of Duluth are, St. Luke's is 56%, St. Mary's is 62%, and Miller-Dwan is almost 66%. And you'll notice that St. Joseph's is 71%.
Senator, I think when you're talking about public payments here, you've included Medicare.
Yes.
And we're not cutting Medicare in this legislative session at least. So we need to be careful when we are.
That's true, Madam Chair.
And Madam Chair, let me also say that we'd like to see that information as well, and maybe sit down with the Hospital Association to reconcile the information for you. We don't eliminate GAMC. You mentioned that. That's not proposed.
Well, there's a ratable reduction, Madam Chair. There's
right. That and this, remember, this $21 million on this page, on page 118, is a reduction in a future payment, not a reduction in a future, in a present rate or a present payment. That you need to make. That's why we need to sit down with you and make distinction as to what future payments are being affected, as opposed to what current payments are being affected. You got to make that distinction.
Madam Chair,
Senator Prentice-Sullivan.
Yeah, Mr. Osberg, there is. You do eliminate the GAMC for parents without children,
which Madam is almost everybody.
Madam,
in the program.
Madam Chair, we do not eliminate GAMC. We eliminate coverage for adults without kids in Minnesota care. But we do not eliminate general assistance medical care.
Sure they do.
And certainly we do not do that.
So let's go on to the next page.
Page 119, this proposal would delay the last payment of fiscal years 2010 and 2011 for selected non-hospital providers. Payments due in June 2010 would be made in July 2010, and payments due in June 2011 would be made in July 2011. This results in a general fund savings in 10 and 11 biennium by shifting that expense to the next biennium. It's a shift to the next biennium.
Right. Is this a Merck shift?
No, Madam Chair. Oh. This is just the shift in terms of timeliness of payments to non-hospital providers. And we do the same thing. We've done that for the hospital providers in the past, but we don't include certain providers. We don't include ICFMRs, nursing facilities, home and community-based services, or personal care provider organizations, and home health agencies who rely so much on our cash. We have such a high percentage of Medicaid clients. We don't include them in this cash flow change. We do include everyone else, though, in this. And it delays by a couple of weeks. It delays by a month here, roughly. Payment to them in order to shift the cost into the next biennium. Let's call it what it is. It's what we're trying to do here.
So one of the groups that I guess I would be especially concerned about whether they can cash flow this shift would be the community mental health centers. You had any discussion with them as to whether they can cash flow?
Madam Chair, I have not. No, I have not heard that, but I'm not sure if they're included in any of these categories of home and community-based services or.
Well, you've got them on the page here as being included. Another group that I'd be concerned about are federally qualified health care centers, public health clinics.
Yes.
Some of these organizations don't have a lot of private pay money involved in their operations to cushion a shift.
Chair, that's a good point. I'll seek clarification on those two categories.
And so as a result, I think we might like to have, just in case we need it, the value of the shift by provider type.
Madam Chair, yes, we will do that.
Any other questions about this page? Let's move on then.
Then on page 120, this proposal would delay the June fee-for-service payments for inpatient hospital services by 1 month. Again, payments due in June 2010 would be made in July 2010, and payments due in June 2011 would be made in July 2011. It's a $25 million general fund savings for 10-11, again shifted to the next biennium.
Questions about this page?
Page 121. This proposal would eliminate the critical access dental add-on payment for Minnesota Care and Medical Assistance Programs. We're now getting into reimbursement changes here in the next series of pages. A recent analysis, and this is just one factor in our making this proposal, a recent analysis of the critical access dental program provided to the legislature recently concluded that the program has not led to an overall increase in the percent of clients who have received dental care. It's flattened out over the last few years. It's true. We've been able to do that anyway in terms of not having a decrease in access, but we've not been able to accomplish what we've been hoping to accomplish, and that is get an increased access for our clients through a program like this. The primary issue here, however,
I just have to disagree with you. If you go back to before the Critical Access Dental Program was created, and you take and look at what was happening with the number of patient visits for our public patients at that time and compare it to today, we are seeing, because of this program, about twice as many people or twice as many visits. Now, I don't know, when somebody talks about the last couple of years, you know, is it continuing to incrementally grow? I don't know that that's been the case, but I'll tell you something. It is proposals just like this one that turns the cold water on to a dentist thinking about joining this program. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if there, I know you are aware of this, Madam Chair, but I'm not sure whether the other committee members recall that a couple of years ago we made a grant available for enhancing and expanding access to dental care in areas where there was a real problem. And the result of that money has really just now, it's taken a while to get facilities up and running, but in my area, this was a need that people have been working on for over 10 years. The entire community in a very big geographic area of the state recognized this as a need because people on government programs were having to drive 2.5 hours to the nearest facility that would accept this reimbursement rate and these patients. We've just opened our doors on a brand new facility within the last month, and hundreds, literally hundreds, if not thousands of people within the region will be served in that clinic. And the fact that there's this fee enhancement for critical access dental care was specifically stated as a reason they were able to make this work, you know, from a fiscal standpoint. It's really a critical need in our community that was identified across the board. This funding has made it possible, as well as that grant, and I'm sure, you know, I just can't imagine why we would want to undo that. It was such a critical need, and now we've finally gotten there. We're just starting to see the benefit. Be very disappointed if this happened.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, I think it's important that we, again, connect all of the dots and put all the pieces of the puzzle together. And we can all see the projected savings that you have indicated on your change item before us. But what we don't see, and what we're not recognizing, is that, for example, there are over 20,000 visits to emergency rooms for this, for dental and oral health needs. And so that's not reflected here, and I would suggest to you that that is not a savings. And in fact, under proposals like this, those are some of the auxiliary benefits that we glean. So I'm very disappointed, and to the chair's opening comments, once again, we are moving backwards.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, we, in the another proposal later on, we do address the ER impact in terms of eliminating adult coverage for dental. So we do recognize that that's what the impact of this will be, is that people will instead they have to rely on emergency services. The only reason that we frankly addressed changes in the benefit side is to avoid further eligibility cuts. Just to be honest with you, that it's none of these decisions or options are necessarily easy or certainly they impact people in a great way and impact organizations that serve our people in a big way. And but we're trying to best we can to avoid cuts to GAMC or Medicaid, and that's the overall effort here that we're trying to accomplish.
So, Assistant Commissioner, then you would have to admit that the key goal of improving healthcare quality, access, and outcomes for this budget page is not being met by this budget recommendation.
Madam Chair, we realize the impact in our clients in terms of and organizations that we serve, both in terms of the of this, that does set us back in terms of our objective to enhance access and quality of services for our clients.
Are there other questions about this page? Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to comment that, you know, over the last couple of years, I know that the escalation of healthcare costs is a grave concern for the legislature, for you, and the department. But the reforms that we've been looking at, focusing on prevention, trying to reduce costs over the long term, seem to me to be, you know, moving in the direction of trying to address that by and climbing out of that hole in a positive direction. Now we're talking about moving in exactly the opposite direction. I mean, we had an example when the Commission to End Poverty was in Bemidji of someone who'd not been able to access care in our area, ended up going into the emergency room with a severe abscess, had to be flown by helicopter down to the metro area because it had become a life-threatening situation and was hospitalized for a long period of time. I don't remember the exact amount of the bills, but it was well over $100,000. When you think of all the children who could have been served through preventive services, it's just really hard to understand how this is ultimately going to result in a cost saving and isn't just going to escalate that downward spiral in healthcare costs that we were trying to move away from.
Senator, we did talk about that a little bit before you got here, about how many of these proposals are moving us away from the concept of value-based purchasing. Other comments? All right, let's move on then.
Madam Chair, on page 122, this proposal would limit the medical education research costs, MERC, carve-out of the medical assistance capitation rates to comply with the new federal requirements and to restore fiscal year 2009 MERC payments that were that was affected by the unallotment and to delay transfer of MERC funds. In October 2008, DHS received new terms and conditions that limit MERC spending associated with our MA managed care population as part of the renewal of the federal waiver. Beginning with fiscal year 2011, medical education payments associated with our managed care population and distributed to providers are limited in fiscal year 2010 and 2011 to the level of payments made in 2009. Total MERC payments for 2009 are projected to be $34 million, which is arrived at by subtracting $38 million in non-allotment from the $72 million cap. This has three components: amending the MERC and MA capitation rate statutes to ensure that total medical education carve-outs and spending related to MA managed care beneficiaries does not exceed newly imposed federal limits. That's at $72 million. This results in MA savings because payments will remain constant as opposed to growing with the increases in capitation rates. Number two is in fiscal year 2010, this proposal restores $38 million in MERC funding from the governor's 09 unallotment actions. This fully restores the fiscal year 09 MERC payments and restores the federal limit to $72 million for 09. This restoration is partially financed by a temporary reduction of $28 million in the fiscal year 10 MERC payments. We probably need to develop a map for you on how this is going to work. In fact, we do have a schematic as to exactly how this is going to be done. Beginning in fiscal year 11, MERC payments will continue at the $72 million limit. Delaying the transfer of MERC funds carved out of the managed care capitation rates from the DHS to the Department of Health beginning July 1 is the other aspect of this proposal. This action results in one-time savings in fiscal year 11. So overall, there's a $45 million savings for fiscal for biennium 10 and 11. $17 million roughly because of the federal cap, the $72 million cap, another $28 million in which we're reducing. In, the impact is in fiscal year 2011. So we've delayed any impact to 2011, but we're also applying the federal cap that was.
So just to be clear, Assistant Commissioner, it is possible within the cap that was arrived at as a part of the waiver discussion to make a shift in MRC payments without reducing the amount that would be allowed. This could be done in a budget-neutral way, in other words.
No, we, Madam Chair, we cannot. The cap is something that we're going to, is going to affect us. As I said, $17 million of the savings projected here is because of the fact we can't exceed
the cap. I said within the cap, a shift could be done in a budget-neutral way. You have chosen not to do that.
However. Madam Chair, we have gone beyond that. Yes, we have. We've gone $28 million reduction in the MRC funds.
Are there any other questions about this page? Okay, let's move on.
Page.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Again, you know, with our health care reform and the reliance on medical homes and the need for family practice practitioners, especially in our rural areas, these MRC funds really go a lot to the medical education of those family practice residents. And the great need that we have in expanding that in our state if we're going to implement our health care reform. So this, again, is a way that is limiting our reform initiatives from our past couple of years.
Well, and I think it has a very disproportionate impact on teaching institutions.
Yes.
Madam Chair, that's why we have... in essence, restore the 09 unallotment cuts and deferred this effect until 2011. We realized the importance of that as well, especially in developing primary care physicians. And so we understand the importance of MRC, and that's why we have corrected in part our current action.
Well, Assistant Commissioner, in fairness, the recommendation that I made to the governor to do a MRC shift was just to do a shift, not to do an unallotment that would not include a shift. And so, you know, to say you're restoring an unallotment, I think, is a bit misleading. It was always intended to be a shift, which would just be a delay in payment rather than a cut in payment. Senator Laurie.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And I guess we'll just once again point out the irony of the key goals and measures on another one of these cuts that moves us backwards from our goals while stating that the key goal and measure is to improve the health care quality, access, outcomes, and affordability in line with the reforms that we've been working on. And this once again moves us further away from those goals, and yet the pages seem to indicate that it's helping us in that regard. So we'll point out that irony one more time.
Any other questions on this page? Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move on.
Page 125, this proposal would make a 1 percentile reduction in the fee-for-service pharmacy pharmacy reimbursement rate. It would be reduced to the current rate of average wholesale price, AWP minus 14%, be reduced to AWP minus 15% for fee-for-service and medical assistance.
So did you intentionally skip page 124?
I'm coming back to that again.
I guess our index isn't quite as helpful.
Oh, Madam Chair, that is being addressed by the Chemical and Mental Health Administration because of the impact on our provider capacity. That page is going to be presented by Assistant Commissioner.
So it really doesn't belong on this sheet.
No, it does not. We think that would be best presented by Assistant Commissioner Solik.
All right. Let's go on then to pharmacy.
The change would apply to all MA and GAMC fee-for-service pharmacy prescriptions except specialty products and products purchased under what's called a 340B arrangement that we have with certain providers. The reduction would apply to branded drugs and to the few multi-source products that are not priced generic products. They're not priced using Minnesota's maximum allowable cost program. This results in a $2.4 million general fund savings.
Are there questions about this page? Okay, if not, let's move on.
Budget page 126. This proposal eliminates the enhanced payment to hospitals in greater Minnesota for certain diagnoses under the medical assistance and JAMC programs. This is the rural 16 DRG payments. The proposal eliminates the enhanced payment of the greater of a hospital's cost-based rate, or 90% of the seven-county metro average rate for these 16 DRGs. That's how that works. Now, again, remember, the hospitals are paid based on their actual cost, and we rebase that every 2 years. We missed 05 and 09. Next time is going to be 2011. This provision then says that instead of being paid that rate based on their cost, they may be paid 90% of the average metro rate, which includes medical education. Speaking back of medical education, so the metro hospitals, especially the ones that have medical education, have a higher rate. So it's 90% of the metro average or their cost as calculated through our process. They get paid the highest of those two calculations. There are about 79 hospitals receive these extra or this enhanced payment, and this will be effective July 1st of 2009. We also have again, this gets back to the complication of how we pay for hospitals. We have another law that provides small rural hospitals, less than 79, a 15% or 20% increase in their payments based on MA volume. That payment is not affected in this proposal.
Madam Chair.
Senator Prentner-Solon.
There is a strong argument for this, though, Assistant Commissioner. The cost to our hospitals in greater Minnesota do not differ significantly to the cost in the metro area. And the metro area is getting like, is it 112%? Whereas prior to implementation of this formula, there were many hospitals in greater Minnesota that were getting 70% of the metro area payment. And their cost to hire their nursing staff, their physicians, their to pay for their MRIs and their equipment is the same as it costs in the metro area. So there needs to be a way for them to survive in greater Minnesota as well as there is in the metro area.
Madam Chair, Senator Prentner-Solon, again, maybe because of the efficiency of some of those greater Minnesota hospitals, their costs are lower. They get paid based on their cost, their specific cost. So maybe their costs are lower than metro hospitals. Yes, they would get paid. Under our current statute, that's how they get paid. They get paid their cost. Now, there's a lag to that.
Rebasing doesn't occur.
If rebasing doesn't occur, right, then there's an impact there. But so that may be very true that greater Minnesota hospitals are less expensive than metro hospitals. And these,
I don't believe that's happening. Mm-hmm. And we also have medical education, and we have teaching institutions in our greater Minnesota cities, too.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Prentner-Solon, I'm sure that's a very great deal. And so I think we have to, again, look at this overall method by which we pay hospitals. This hospital cost-based method, I'm not sure if that's the best way of paying for hospitals going down the road at all. Because that doesn't necessarily, it's not very reforming in terms of how we pay for hospital services. I think we need to revisit, frankly,
the whole Assistant system. Commissioner, I would invite you then, with your dozens and dozens of staff people, to go back to your office and develop a proposal for paying for hospital care based on value-based purchasing, based on the health care reform that we worked on last year, instead of this kind of garbage.
Madam Chair, we are working with the health department and the private sector in developing the facets of care that could potentially be used for us to structure our payment mechanisms in the future. We do want to look at different ways of providing, but we want to do it in the context of working with the private sector and not do it prematurely. We're not in a position to do that this session. But
I disagree with you.
I'm sure we're glad to talk about how we will participate and benefit from the healthcare reform aspects of the legislation that was enacted last year, but it's not going to be timely
for
this
session.
Well,
so far we haven't gotten one budget page that shows that we're going to benefit financially in any way from the reform that was passed last year or any reform that you might be thinking of for the future.
Madam Chair, we had some of these proposals that were enacted last year, healthcare.
But we never got any savings for them. And we're not getting any this year.
Again, we'd be glad to come back and talk about how we can, how we will and can benefit and participate in the reform piece going forward. Everything else is still in place in terms of the healthcare reform legislation. It's true, in terms of the proposals here, is a major impact in terms of people covered. And that was part of the, obviously part of the effort is to try to get improved access for people. Other aspects of the healthcare reform legislation is still in place that the health departments are responsible for and that we're responsible for. We're moving forward with that. And that's not impacted by our budget proposals nor by the health department's proposals.
Well, I mean, you know, our vision was everybody would have a medical home. I would clearly say at least 113,000 people in this proposal won't have a medical anything. All they'll have is an emergency room. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I think that it's a bit disingenuous to suggest that hospitals are being reimbursed or based on their cost. And I would just point out that when you're talking about their cost from, for example, 2002, I think that's very different than their costs today. So I think it's good to acknowledge what we're really talking about there. And the other thing that I would say is it caught my eye with the 16 DRGs that you identify here, because these are the very services that we see most often in our hospitals. And your comment about, you know, we don't know if we have time this session or we're not ready to. I would like to let the division know that I am working on a bill that will establish best practices and benefit set specifically in this area, because it is such a significant part of our healthcare costs within our hospitals. And I think that there are some proven measures out there that we need to entertain in Minnesota. And I'm specifically thinking about information that was brought forward by the Milbank Foundation in this regard. And I'm excited to continue working on that, and we'll look forward to bringing that to the division.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I guess I'd just like to add that it concerns me when I hear the department talking about continuing to work and put its efforts towards some of the things that last session legislatively didn't pass as part of the healthcare reform, because we had a lot of concerns raised from smaller rural hospitals about how they were going to survive under those proposals. And it seems to me like we're continuing to go forward with a direction that's going to make it more and more difficult to even have hospitals outside of maybe one or two locations around outside the metro area. I would really encourage the department to not bring forward proposals that don't have at least some buy-in by our smaller rural hospitals and a plan for how they're going to be protected. I mean, on just about all levels, from including recruiting physicians, as Senator Prettner-Solon alluded to, it's becoming more and more difficult to manage those facilities.
Madam Chair and Senator Lynch and Olson, let me clarify that, indeed, our payment for hospitals isn't a cost-based payment, but I'm not suggesting that it's been caught up. we've not caught up to their actual costs. I'm not suggesting that at all. In fact, because of the lag that you just talked about in terms of the rebasing, plus we've had ratable reductions to hospitals that we'll talk about further in a few minutes. No, I want to make clear that I don't believe we're not caught up to their actual cost because of those two factors. And I've agreed that this short term, especially this proposal, these proposals affect the ability for hospitals to provide services on an ongoing basis. And we know that's going to add to their uncompensated care obligation and to their charity care obligation. We realize that. We recognize that's the effect of some of this legislation.
And Assistant Commissioner, do you recognize the impact it might have on jobs?
Madam Chair, we realize what's going on in the healthcare industry right now in terms of the reduction in jobs, and certainly the fact that we will, in our calculation, based on the specific proposals, there's going to be $170 million less payment to providers in this biennium, to hospitals in this biennium, will add to that problem.
Well, it's more than that because there's 113,000 people that they aren't going to get paid to see. It'll be showing up in their emergency rooms. So, I mean, it isn't just about reducing payment. It's all of it combined. Our information is that the total impact will be approximately 10,600 jobs, which certainly isn't something we need to have happening at this point in time in terms of helping our economy to recover. Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much. In terms of discussing the rebasing issue that we just talked about and the change item on rural hospital inpatient DRG payments, are you acknowledging that it is the rural hospitals, the rural healthcare delivery system, that is bearing a significant responsibility for helping resolve the budget deficit?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I think the entire hospital system, metro or rural, is being impacted by this, and I don't know if it necessarily. We haven't calculated the impact by specific hospital, so I don't.
Senator Sharon, I don't have anything
to say about that.
I think that it is a mischaracterization to talk about it in terms of urban and rural, because within the metro area, there are hospitals that aren't going to be affected very much by this budget at all. And there are other hospitals that are going to be greatly affected by these proposals.
Madam Chair, I don't think that we can deny that the last two subjects we're talking about, rebasing, which really is necessary for the rural hospitals to survive, and this item, which is the rural inpatient DRG payments, are what are being impacted by this, that it has to be said that these efforts that have been made over a long period of time in a combined effort of all of the state to acknowledge the need to resolve issues for rural healthcare delivery systems is being significantly impacted by this. I'm not saying that there aren't the safety net systems in the metro area that are also being impacted by changes, but these are very specific.
Rebasing affects metro hospitals too. I mean, sit down with Children's Hospital one day, find out what impact the lack of rebasing has had on them.
Well, Children's Hospital is a unique hospital, provides a very specific purpose for the entire state, and we need to be very concerned about how rebasing impacts them. But I will not back away from talking about or expressing concerns about how we are making policy changes here that have an effect on our rural capacity to be able to provide services in the rural part of the state.
Well, I think it's the job of the division to think about how this impacts the whole state, all of this.
including the rural part of the state.
They are part of the state, yes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Just to follow up on Senator Sharon's comments, you know, what has been explained to me is that the mix in rural communities, it draws from a much smaller, there's much less variety in the patient population. So the flexibility that rural hospitals have to make adjustments within their, in order to survive, you know, within their financial structure is much more limited. And it's not as though those of us who represent rural areas don't recognize that there are hospitals in the metro area that also serve similar types of populations and have similar types of financial challenges. It's just that there's less variety in rural communities, and there are some special challenges there that have to do with economies of scale, that have to do with difficulties attracting physicians. I mean, we could go through and kind of list a host of unique concerns, and that's not to say that metro hospitals don't have, you know, some of those concerns as well. But when you lose your hospital in rural Minnesota that's serving a whole region, you have nowhere else to go. And that's, you know, that's a unique challenge that we have in rural Minnesota, and just something, a concern I share with Senator Sharon, and I'm sure a concern we all share.
Well, and I would say that your constituent that got airlifted to the metro hospitals did not get airlifted to a hospital that's not going to be impacted by this budget. And conversely, you know, when people are on vacation or go to their summer cabins and have an incident, a healthcare incident occur, they rely on your hospitals. Mm-hmm. So we need to be thinking about this as how it affects the whole state. Let's move on then.
The next item is on page 128. This proposal would eliminate the hospital quarterly payments under medical assistance.
We're on page 128.
Effective July 1st, 2009. These quarterly payments are add-ons to the base inpatient rate that we currently pay. Eliminating the quarterly payments will not have an impact on existing rates paid to hospitals, which are based on hospital-specific costs that are rebased every 2 years, as I mentioned earlier.
I'd just like to interrupt you for a minute. I'd like everybody to cross off the title of this page because it's very confusing. And I'd like you to write at the top of your page, eliminate hospital dish payments.
Madam Chair, this is technically not the dish payment. This is an add-on to the dish. We maximize dish payments from the federal government to the state. This is an add-on to that.
This is the increased amount that was allowed by the federal government. They're going to allow another increased amount. So you want to call it an add-on, that's fine. But really, it's trying to maximize our dish payments. That's what this is. Senator Pretner-Solon.
And Madam Chair, in addition to what you're saying, and something that also needs to be pointed out is that for all the cuts that the state is making, these hospitals are also losing the federal match on these dollars.
Oh, yes. In most of these proposals, that's true. And they're losing whatever enhanced FMAP there might be coming.
Right. As you can see, Madam Chair, members, the result of the savings goes down over time because what happens is that first take off the 4% off the top, if you will, from that to towards the bottom line and towards general fund. And so over time, because of increasing costs in hospital, you're going to see that this is going to go away. Now, it still has a big impact for 10 and 11, but it has, as you see, a smaller impact in 12 and 13, and at some point we may not even see any quarterly payments being made through the current structure.
We need the detail on fiscal year 12 and 13. It's not shown on the budget pages that we
have.
Sure,
we will provide that, right.
And while we're at it, we also, in the next week, need to have every one of these budget pages broken down as to how much of the savings is calculated based on the healthcare access fund and how much is based on the general fund.
Madam Chair, we will do that.
Other questions about this page? Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in addition to those additional breakdowns that you're asking for, I wonder if we would be able to get on one page the cumulative effect of the loss of federal dollars matching so that we take that into consideration, too, as we look at impact on hospitals and healthcare in Minnesota. Because that's going to be extremely powerful as well. Not only are we losing dollars out of our system with Minnesota money, it's going to be a double, triple, or sometimes quadruple whammy from the feds.
Okay, we'll make that request as well, Senator Lynch.
And, Madam Chair, as long as we're on the issue of detail, I think it'd be important that we also ask for specific detail with regard to Bethesda and Gillette Children's, because it's as noted here, they are treated a bit differently in this equation as well. So I'd like that detail to be included.
One other request, that is that as much as I did not want to do it at the time, we were forced, really, by the House at that time and the administration to use as our match for DISH GAMC. And this, and among the other proposals we have here is a reduction in GAMC. And so we need to know if that will affect our ability to draw DISH dollars, whether we accept this page or not.
Madam Chair, we can do that analysis.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, so long as you mentioned GAMC, I have a question on that. I wonder if the Commissioner could just clarify for my understanding. But GAMC has not been eliminated for physician services, but has been eliminated for hospitals. Is that, am I understanding that correctly?
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, no, GAMC has not been affected in terms of eligibility. It has been affected in terms of benefits that we're going to cover, as we'll talk about in a few minutes, in terms of podiatry.
So why don't we just wait till we get there?
But GAMC, in terms of eligibility, has not been affected.
Okay, any more questions about the DISH payment page?
Page 129. Madam Chair, this proposal would eliminate the outreach incentive program and grants. This program provides an incentive payment to organizations that directly identify and assist potential enrollees to fill out and submit an application for Minnesota healthcare programs. For each successful enrollment, the organization receives $25. This proposal reduces the projected average monthly enrollment assumed in the forecast for MA and Minnesota Care by 5,300 enrollees by fiscal year 2011, but does not impact currently enrolled individuals.
Right, and this isn't really a reimbursement change. This is an eligibility change. This outreach was to increase our enrollment.
Madam Chair, that's a good point. That's true.
Any other questions on this page?
And Madam Chair, let's move on, we're going to go back to 96, page 96. This proposal would reduce the payment rate for basic health care services by 3% under medical assistance and GAMC. 3% ratable reduction would also apply to the managed care contracts under MA and GAMC. This change would be effective July 1st, 2009 for fee-for-service and January 1st, 2010 for managed care contracts. This proposal excludes payments for prescription drugs, medical supplies, and prosthetics, lab and radiology, and medical transportation. There's $88.8 million general fund savings and $7.5 million healthcare access fund savings for the biennium.
And I think this is another instance where we'd like to have the various providers' impact broken down. One of the things we notice in here is that you're including dental and mental health.
Yes, Madam Chair. In fact, also, we're going to be producing to the legislature in a couple of weeks, I believe within a month anyway, a study that the legislature directed us to do in terms of the impact access health care for our clients based on the current payment structure. That will help inform the legislature in terms of the current arrangement and to, as to the impact of access for our clients. So you, that will they'll be delivered to you, as I said, within the next few weeks, no later than the month, I believe.
Well, let's hope we have time to read it by the time we get it. Yes. Other questions on this page? All right, let's move on.
Now move to page 101. Now, if you go to the green pages, you can, pages 13 and 14 in the back of your book, you'll see what kind of benefits we cover for each program. And then pages 23 and 24 list the mandatory and optional Medicaid services. The federal government requires each state to provide certain services, certain benefits, and then the state has the option to cover others. This is a reference for you in terms of, as we talk about the benefit changes that we're proposing. So on page 101, this proposal would discontinue coverage for chiropractic services for non-pregnant adults age 21 and above for MA, GAMC, and Minnesota Care. Chiropractic services are optional for certain populations under federal regulations, as noted in that document in the back. Chiropractic services are covered under Medicare, and Minnesota Healthcare programs will continue to pay the coinsurance and deductible for dual eligibles. We have 100,000 of our 700,000 people are dually eligible. They're on Medicare and Medicaid. Medicare does cover chiropractic services for those 100,000 people. And, of course, this does not apply to children, to the extent children receive chiropractic services. The fiscal analysis for this proposal assumes that 20% of the chiropractic services shift to other services. This results in a $1.26 million total fund savings between general fund and healthcare access fund.
So if 20% is shifting someplace else, we'd like to see where.
I'm sure we will provide that.
Other questions on this page? Not, let's move on.
Page 102, this proposal would discontinue dental coverage for non-pregnant adults age 21 and above for MA, GAMC, and Minnesota Care. Dental coverage, again, is an optional coverage. Dental coverage will continue for children through age 20, pregnant women. Adults would continue to receive emergency dental care through hospital emergency departments, and certain procedures underway at the effective date of this change would continue to be covered. And you see the financial impact, $37.5 million savings in 10 and 11. This fiscal analysis assumes that savings are offset by 10% in fiscal year 10 and an additional 5% each year to account for a shift to emergency care services.
And I guess we need to see that also, that
breakdown.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
My question is, where do you get that number? You know, is that just kind of a guess? Or has there ever been a reputable study done that you would base those numbers on to say if people are going to the emergency room and accessing services there, what percentage will end up there if they don't get primary care? I mean, or is that just kind of a number that's pulled out of someone's hat?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, we have a staff, researchers and forecasters, economists. George Hoffman heads that up, and they do a lot of research in these issues, and I'm sure they relied on experiences elsewhere, we can provide the underlying assumption, underlying factor that he developed or his team developed as to, you're talking about the emergency services impact in terms of how he came up with those numbers. So we can provide that.
And Assistant Commissioner, really, in terms of displaying an honest budget page, you should be showing whatever the shift in costs would be as a cost against the savings on this budget page.
Madam Chair.
Because we don't think we should just be appropriating based on something showing up in a future forecast. So if there are emergency room costs, they're going to result as a result of this page. Those costs should show up on this page.
Madam Chair, as you know, you don't actually appropriate to specific cost categories, but you do. It's the grants, the MA grants, the basic health care grants is what's affected here. Well,
it's okay. We do this in other areas of the budget. We do it in long-term care. You know, if we're not going to provide alternative care, then it's going to show up as increased costs in nursing home, part of the Medicaid budget.
Okay.
We should be doing that for these pages as well. Any other questions about this non-reform page? Let's move on then.
Page 104, Madam Chair, this proposal would discontinue podiatry services for non-pregnant adults age 21 and above for MA, GAMC, and Minnesota Care. Again, podiatry is an optional benefit under federal regulations. Elderly and disabled, many of whom are dually eligible, receive the greatest number of podiatry services. This proposal assumes they will continue coverage under the Medicare, for which our programs pay their co-insurance and deductibles. Again, 100,000 of our clients will be covered through Medicare for this, but and the savings are $1.2 million in the 10-11 biennium.
Are there any questions about this page? Okay, let's move on then.
Page 105, this proposal would discontinue rehabilitative services for non-pregnant adults age 21 and above for MA, GAMC, and Minnesota Care. Rehabilitative services are optional for certain populations, again, under federal regulations. Again, elderly and persons with disabilities with long-term care, long-term chronic and debilitating conditions, as well as children with chronic conditions, receive the majority of rehabilitative services. Again, these services are covered under Medicare for the 100,000 clients, adult clients that we have on Medicare. For children under 21, rehabilitative services are covered under the EPSDT, the Early and Periodic Screening, Diagnostic, and Treatment Benefit. For any children that with special needs, that will be covered under our EPSDT program.
So, Madam Chair.
Assistant Commissioner, are there other costs to this proposal if people are not able to get physical therapy or audiology or?
Madam Chair, I don't know offhand. We'll find that out. There may be other costs in terms of inpatient costs.
Yeah, I would think.
I don't know the details of that. I apologize. I will. We'll get that to you.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Pretner Solon.
Madam Chair, along those same lines, how about adults that have strokes? Would they not then be eligible for rehabilitation services? Then there would obviously be increased inpatient care, too.
And long-term care, I would think.
Long-term care.
Madam Chair, we'll provide that analysis. Our medical director was hoping to be here. He had a family matter that came up this morning. He's unable to be here to answer these kind of questions. I want him to address these issues about impact in terms of health care as well as financial impact. And we will get that to you. I apologize for not having that resource here today.
Other questions?
Madam Chair, Commissioner Osberg.
Senator Coring.
I'm just going back a little bit. Which green page did you refer to when you were talking about the chiropractic stuff? I guess.
Yeah, you go back in the back, way in the back of your.
Yeah, we have this little appendix back here.
If you go to page 23 in the green pages in the back, you'll see which benefits are mandatory and which benefits are...
Okay, thank you very much.
For example, pharmacy services, pharmacy...
is an optional service that you manage not to cut. I can't imagine what kind of stroke of luck that was.
Madam Chair, there are a lot of optional benefits we did not cut, of course.
Well, you know, it's just really not your fault. I don't believe the way the Medicaid program has been structured in terms of optional services really makes any sense. And really, if we're going to be doing value-based purchasing and trying to get things out of the system that are not necessary, looking at the optional services is not the way to do it. There are other better ways to do it in terms of structuring co-payments, structuring reduced provider payments, prior authorization. There are a number of ways of getting things that are not beneficial to the healthcare delivery system out of the system. And, you know, because the federal government has designed or designated certain services as optional services does not mean they're optional in terms of people's health outcomes.
Madam Chair, I would agree with that assessment in that what we're trying to do is we have the Health Services Advisory Committee that's been established to look at evidence-based criteria, determine how we should cover services, under what situation should we cover services. And we were doing that. We've been doing that effectively in the last year, and we can give you an update on that. We think that is a more effective way to determine a value-based benefit set, because that's what we want to get to over time, is a value-based benefit set as part of our healthcare reform idea, not just changing the way we pay for services, but changing the way we cover services based on evidence-based criteria. And I would agree with your perspective on that.
Well, unfortunately, these proposals are not moving us in that direction. Other questions about this page?
Madam Chair, page 112, this proposal would eliminate the patient incentive grant program. This grant program would provide incentives and rewards to enrollees who have met personal health goals established with the patient's primary care providers in managing a chronic disease such as diabetes. This mirrors the arrangement that we have in rewarding providers for reaching those objectives. This was enacted by the 2007 legislature and has not yet been implemented. It's not yet received federal approval. Discontinuation of this grant would be effective July 1st, 2009.
Any questions on this page? Let's move on then.
I would like to turn, Madam Chair and members, to page 113. We'll now go over the eligibility changes in these next series of budget change pages. Madam Chair, this proposal would simplify program eligibility standards and provide greater operational support and oversight to improve county administration of Minnesota healthcare programs. We are requesting a state investment in this case in making this happen. The current healthcare programs have developed over 40 years with great complexity. The current eligibility and enrollment system needs to be restructured to ensure client access and to better utilize administrative resources at the county level and state level. The system complexity was verified by the 2007 OLA report. In response, DHS has established a joint state-county advisory committee that identified ways to simplify and streamline health, human services, and administrative requirements. The result of this county and state partnership is a business process redesign initiative called Minnesota Healthcare Connect. The resulting report recommended improvements, many of which are incorporated in this proposal. The goals of this proposal include, one, reducing program complexity by streamlining eligibility policies, number two, increasing statewide operational support and oversight, number three, reducing county administrative costs, four, improving client services, five, reducing systems costs, six, reducing enrollee confusion and increased workload from additional renewal notices.
This proposal, from a policy perspective, seeks to address the ongoing concern that eligible clients be enrolled in the program that provides the best benefit set at the lowest cost for the client. In an effort to address these concerns, this proposal eliminates duplicative coverage of Minnesota Care for pregnant women, children under age 2, children 2 to 18 with income at or below 150% of poverty, and children 19 to 20 with income at or below 100% of federal poverty. These populations would be covered primarily by medical assistance, exclusively by medical assistance, effective July 1st, 2011, or upon federal approval. You will note that the financing for this change occurs in the next biennium. So this means that the Minnesota Care, who will be in Minnesota Care going forward under this proposal, are children 2 to 18 with incomes above 150% of poverty. Other children will be in medical assistance. Under 150% will be in medical assistance. Children 19 to 20 with income above 100% of poverty will be in Minnesota Care, up to 275% of poverty. And align certain eligibility rules for Minnesota. Another aspect of this is to align certain eligibility rules for Minnesota healthcare programs, which include changing income methodology, implementing six-month reviews for Minnesota Care, and aligning asset verification requirements, again, effective July 1st, 2011, or upon federal approval. Now, what this does is maintain compliance with federal mandates for the Minnesota Care waiver renewal, which you can find, if you wish to review the summary of that, you can find in your green page, page 18. This includes expedited MA eligibility determinations for certain families disenrolled from Minnesota Care for failure to pay premiums. To help mitigate the increased administrative burden for counties, this proposal requires that the State Minnesota Care Operations Unit develop the capacity to redetermine MA eligibility for former families with children who were disenrolled from Minnesota Care for failure to pay premiums. Remember, again, if that is a factor, in some cases it's a factor, when families in Minnesota Care are unable to pay their premium, kids may be eligible for medical assistance with no premium. So what we want to do is facilitate that, not refer them back to the county. We want Minnesota Care Operations to be able to determine that. And that's what this is trying to accomplish. We're trying to streamline the eligibility process and simplify our eligibility criteria in order to make this a more effective set of programs. DHS proposes to provide further county workload relief by having the State Minnesota Healthcare Operations Unit retain healthcare-only MA family cases that go through redetermination process. Beginning in fiscal year 2011, we propose implementing a statewide support unit for complex long-term care cases. This is another area of difficulty for counties in trying to process the applications for long-term care. They're very complicated. And we're suggesting that perhaps the state should centralize. We should do that on behalf of the counties. This proposal results in a net increase of just over 13 FTEs and a $1.45 million increase in healthcare spending for healthcare access fund spending for 10 and 11 biennium. This is in order to support the development and implementation of these streamlining of these eligibility standards and to support the Minnesota Care waiver requirements that I just referenced and to assist families with children in Minnesota Care who are disenrolled for failure to pay premiums. And the FTEs will also be used to implement the specialized support unit for determining long-term care eligibility. So in this case, we're asking that you consider our investment to simplify and streamline and improve services and in our program for our clients and for counties and all involved.
So, Assistant Commissioner, again, we're not being shown any enrollment effect for the six-month review of Minnesota Care cases. We know it has a fairly large impact based on when we made the change to go to annual enrollment. We need a breakdown of the exact attachment of the 13.75 FTEs to the various proposals that are included here. And we need to actually see the documentation that would require us to have a six-month review policy regarding Minnesota Care enrollees.
Madam Chair, we will provide that to you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pretner-Solon?
I'm wondering if we could, if there'd be time to have a presentation on this, on these changes, where we could see them or how it's going to occur.
We also would like to know, as you're tracking the federal stimulus bill very closely, which of these changes would be prohibited in that bill if we're going to be able to receive that money.
Madam Chair, I'll address that in a few minutes.
Well, obviously, some of this page is affected by that.
Madam Chair, this page is not so much because this page we're not changing eligibility. We're changing as to which programs people will be enrolled into. This page does not actually change eligibility.
Well, the six-month review would be.
Six-month review may be, because you write the, that's one thing we're assessing right now, because in the proposed stimulus package legislation, there is a provision that says that we are to have the same standards, methodology, and procedures for eligibility as we had back in July of 2008, if we were to be eligible for this increased federal Medicaid funds. We're trying to assess exactly what standards, methodologies, and procedures mean. It's very possible that eligibility, frequency of eligibility determination would be one of those standards or procedures.
And I guess we are wondering if there's any reason why the department cannot assign a Minnesota Care worker to a case so that when a client calls up about their Minnesota Care enrollment, that they could get the same person. We continually now are getting complaints that a worker has said this piece of information is missing, so they get that piece of information. And then they call up and they get a different worker, and the different worker says, oh, no, that piece of information wasn't a problem. Now there's something else that's a problem. And, you know, really and truly, sometimes it takes people 6 months to get enrolled in the program, which is why we wanted to go to annual, why we did go to annual enrollment, because there is no reason people should have to spend their whole life getting enrolled over and over again. And if it takes you 6 months, you never actually are enrolled. You're just always in the process of getting enrolled. And certainly some of that could be reduced if people could have the same worker contact every time they are contacting the department.
Madam Chair, we'll provide to you details as to how we manage that process of an application coming in and to how we handle that. So
they get rid of a bunch early.
We are meeting within the 30 days certainly of processing applications. We received the contingency payment that you provided to us last year, the $240,000. We met that, and
well, of course, that is
in progress.
If somebody has 30 days from the date somebody's provided you all the information. But if they keep getting a different story from a different worker about what information is needed, that can drag it on to take 6 months before the 30 days starts to apply.
Madam Chair, we'll provide that information as to exactly how we process those kind of arrangements and the services that we provide to our clients.
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, I just as a suggestion, I know before coming to the legislature, when I had to deal with a government agency that dealt with subrogation, the people who worked in that area had divided responsibilities according to the alphabet of the person's last name. And so when you called, you always got that person. And if you look at the number of people you have assigned and you figure out how many letters in the alphabet they would have to take based on the number of people working, I mean, it's just a very simple way to make sure that people are always directed back to the same person again. I mean, whether it's alphabetically or by dividing numbers and Social Security numbers or whatever, I can't imagine it would be that complicated to do.
You're right, Senator. Other questions on this page? Not, let's move on.
Now we're going to refer you back to page 97. This proposal would eliminate eligibility of Minnesota Care and what we call the GHO or hospital only program and Minnesota Care for Adults Without Children. Eliminate the GAMC hospital only program effective January 1st, and that's when somebody comes in an episode basis, goes to the hospital. Income is between 75 and 175%, and then they get. Hospital gets reimbursed and for physician and hospital services with the $1,000 cost sharing arrangement, and so that that program would be eliminated January 1st of 2010. This also eliminates the transitional Minnesota Care program, which moved adults without children from GAMC over to Minnesota Care. This is based on legislation that was enacted a couple of years ago. Effective January 1st, 2010, we maintain GAMC at current income and asset limits for applicants and enrollees who have the qualifiers described in current law. And your budget page lists those qualifiers. These are the people that will be continue to be eligible for coverage under general assistance medical care. We have 30-some thousand such clients enrolled in GAMC today, after a lot of other people transitioned over to Minnesota Care. And then this proposal eliminates Minnesota Care eligibility for adults without children effective January 1st, 2010. As I mentioned earlier, this is projected to impact 55,000 people now enrolled. An additional 10,000 adults without kids will be affected, however, in large part because the expansion of coverage to 250% of FPG to the federal poverty guideline would not go into effect this July as scheduled. That was what was enacted last year as part of the health care reform legislation. It was increasing coverage for adults without kids from 200% to 250% of FPG. So there'd be 65,000 adults without kids affected, 55,000 who are currently enrolled, and 10,000 who are not yet enrolled, because we have not implemented that expansion to 250% of the federal poverty guideline. Is that understandable? This proposal represents a reduction in healthcare access fund and general fund spending of $508 million for the 10-11 biennium.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Assistant Commissioner Osberg. Has there been an analysis of where these costs will go? I mean, is there an assumption that the people who are cut from these programs, you know, what percentage of them are just going to go without care they need, and so those costs will just never occur? What percentage of them are going to result in uncompensated care costs for hospitals? What percentage of that cost is going to get shifted to increases in health insurance premium rates for others? I mean, so this just
or
looks
jails,
like
jails, prisons.
Yeah. I mean, this is just showing us savings, but in fairness and in terms of public transparency, how much of this is actually a savings and how much of this is going to be shifted in those other directions? And I'm sure many others I haven't mentioned. Has anyone analyzed that, and is that part of the process that you went through in putting this recommendation together?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, that analysis is not part of this this proposal, but we realize that it'd be a significant shift over to the charity care, non-compensated care obligation of especially hospitals, but also to other safety net providers, fairly qualified health clinics, and other clinics that are providing coverage for people who are uninsured. We realize that there will be an impact in terms of the uninsured rate because of this proposal in this state.
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair and Assistant Commissioner Osberg, I guess just one other thing I would mention is when we're talking about people struggling with jobs and so forth, our whole economy and trying to recover, the number of people who are put into bankruptcy over this kind of a policy change, to me, that also has a big trickle-out impact in our economy, making it harder for people to get jobs in the future, get back on their feet, deal with the difficulties everyone's experiencing because of the economic downturn. But I just wonder if we aren't relegating people to permanent poverty even when the economy turns around through this kind of a shift, if they happen to get, you know, substantially or have a significant medical problem during this time.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, what will be available, of course, is if adults without kids under 75%, or any of these adults without children, have developed a disability, then they'll go through the process of having that disability certified, and then may be eligible for medical assistance. We realize that a number of people may be in that category, but certainly that doesn't help until they're in that situation.
The process takes several years. And during that time, they need to document that they are in need of continuing medical care. And during that time, it's possible that some or all of that medical care won't be able to be paid for.
I'm sure that is right. That's a fair characterization of this. But we do assume some people will transfer over to medical assistance because of developing a disability.
I also think that, you know, let's just take, for example, police officers bringing somebody in for a 72-hour hold, you know, trying to establish whether this person has a permanent residence in order to determine if they're going to be eligible or not. I mean, this is going to become very difficult and possibly even encourage people to be homeless in order to get the health care they need. Are there other questions about this page? We have maybe time for one more here.
On page 111, this proposal would eliminate additional 2 months of MA coverage and automatic Minnesota care coverage for children who are ineligible because of excess family income. Go over 150% of the MA standard. This proposal, which was enacted a couple years ago, would allow kids to stay on for a couple of additional months and then automatically go into Minnesota care. The most recent Minnesota care waiver extension that was submitted in December 2007 and approved, as you know, this past fall. The waiver is currently approved through the next 3 years. During the waiver renewal process, CMS denied Minnesota's request to include this initiative enacted in 2007 that would provide additional 2 months of MA coverage and automatic coverage in Minnesota care. And CMS indicated that DHS could resubmit this waiver request outside of the full waiver renewal process. However, they questioned whether or not we could meet the budget neutrality provisions. However, they didn't fully dismiss the possibility of this being resubmitted, but they certainly did not approve it this past fall and again, discouraged our approval of this. This proposal does not affect current enrollees, but reduce future forecasted enrollment increases in MA by 4,400 and in Minnesota care by 9,000 children by the end of the biennium.
And I'm sure you're aware that we do have legislation in this biennium that requests that you resubmit the waiver request on this item.
Madam Chair, yes, we're familiar.
All right, well, just one more of the Minnesota Eustacare pages. I think we have to stop now, unfortunately, because it is 11 o'clock and we have session. Would it be possible for you to return on Monday morning? We have smaller boards, and we're going to be reviewing those Monday morning. We have session at 10, so it's a shorter time period, but we're really trying to finish before the time we announce the public testimony, because we have over 65 people so far that have signed up to testify, and to contact those people and for them to try to reschedule their day that they took off from work to come and testify would become very difficult. So, Assistant Commissioner, do you think that might be possible for you to be here Monday morning?
Yes, Madam Chair, I will be here.
All right, we'll plan on that then. Thank you, members. Meeting's adjourned.